Good afternoon. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. Today we have a special meeting, a public forum called Moral Decisions, a Theosophical Approach to Everyday Ethics. Actually, we had this same forum last spring, and it was so well received and generated so many interesting questions and comments that we decided to do it again, but with different soul-searching questions. So throughout the afternoon, we will have a series of presentations that will follow one after the other. We'll go for four presentations, lasting about 7 or 8 minutes, leaving us time for questions and answers, comments, and then we'll move on to the next subject, and then after we go through those four, we'll take a break for a while and then come back to complete the program. So we'll have our first presenter join us up here now. These first talks this morning are going to look at the ways we generally decide to make our moral decisions. And then as we move along, we'll get into some more practical applications. So our first presentation basically asks the question, can we get beyond the golden rule? Can we do better than the golden rule?
Well, can we do better than the golden rule? We all know the golden rule. It's do unto others as we would have them do unto us. And in fact, the golden rule is found in every major world religion, in the texts of every world religion. So on the one hand, we can say if our motive is to be of service to others, whatever we do for others with the right motive, that is a moral thing to do. But is having the right motive going to guarantee us that what we do for others is really what's best for them? Because wouldn't we want them to do what's best for us? Well, the golden rule works in societies, perhaps, that, you know, where everybody kind of thinks the same, looks the same, same religion, and all the different external things. The golden rule generally will work. But, you know, these days, especially in America, what once was perceived as a melting pot is actually recognized today as more of a tossed salad. And that's okay, as long as we realize that everybody's together in the same tossed salad and we show respect for the differences. So if we want to be of service to others, to do unto others as they would do unto us, that requires right motive. But it also requires intelligence and wisdom. And and Theosophy gives us a basis for that wisdom from the perspective of developing compassion within ourselves, compassion being essentially the sole power of being able to put oneself, figuratively speaking, in someone else's shoes. And if we do that, then we might have a better understanding on doing unto others as they need it rather than as we might want it in our situation. So this idea of the golden rule gives the fish, yet also teaches the person how to fish. And if we do it right, then it could even teach the other, by us setting the example, we might even teach the other how to teach others to fish. So this golden rule, some people say, you know, well, everybody's different, so how can anybody really know? Really, is everybody that different on the outside? One's a tomato, one's an onion, right? One's a carrot. But on the inside, inherently, aren't we really all one? And if we are really all one, then don't we really all have the power to know and to connect in certain ways, to reach out to others and creatively find out how to be of service to others, ultimately, yeah, as we would like to have done unto us.
So this idea as presented of the golden rule, just merely doing unto others as I would have them do unto us, is good to a certain extent, but it still takes in the personal desire. So the question is, can we get beyond? Can our moral decisions be based not so much on what we would want for ourselves personally from the others, but a more universal concept of life in terms of the oneness of life and the wisdom about nature and what people need and doing for them from that point of view? So we welcome your questions and comments. Yes.
The golden rule is universal, and it's basically in all religions. But as simple as it sounds, it's phrased differently. There's various ways in which it's phrased. And some ways it's like, well, you wait, it seems to be implied, well, wait to see how they do to you and then return the favor, rather than actively doing first unto others, we think. So did you find that in your...
So the contribution here is, you know, the way that it's expressed in different traditions, the words are different, but of course even just the translation into English, who's to say what the people were thinking? But really the message there, the idea that all religions, the source of all religions, is really the one true doctrine, and the delivery of that is a common delivery, we'd have to say that as close as we can get to compassion, as close as we can use that to develop compassion within ourselves is really what matters. Yes.
From an older student here, we realized that our sense of compassion was perhaps misdirected, helping someone do something. And the comment made was, that's wonderful. However, how will they ever build the muscles to do it for themselves? So you should be assisting, not doing.
So the contribution here is, well, doing unto others, does that mean do it for them? Aren't we, in certain ways, depriving that other individual of developing self-reliance? So we have to, as we said, the motive certainly is there to be of service, but we have to balance our actions with wisdom so that really the outcome is that the person is all the wiser, stronger himself.
Did you ever hand up?
Yes. Yeah, I was just sitting there, well, you know, I say to myself, I just look at it as, I'm looking at it as the great good, and if people, to me, they have a common bond, like, we just got to do good for each other, and I don't kind of get distracted when people do things. Sometimes, you know, it can happen anywhere, and I don't want to get distracted from that common good. And I would just say that maybe this place here has kept my kind of aim about what Theosophy, or I call the brotherhood. I might have read 1,000 books about, but it always spread that there's a brotherhood, so I don't try to get distracted when I see people doing the common good. They could do it anywhere and be anywhere. It could be any religion. So I'm not going to take this to my house. I just took William Penn's prayer for Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. So I don't take that as something like that. I've taken that as like something that's been part of my experience. And maybe it might have magnified when I came here. It's years ago. But at least I know that it was a reality behind it, not just me just wanting to have a wishful wish that I'm going to do good to people. I'm not going to let my common good go down under because people do resentful things. I'm not going to practice that. And no matter how hard it is, I'm just not going to go get swept up in that kind of, it means nothing to me like that.
Thank you for the contribution. And so the suggestion here is, this is an example perhaps where stand ye out and be ye separate is the best thing that we can do for others, rather than participate in what seems to be probably not the best way to live life, and the best way we can react to that is to not be an example, a bad example to them. Thank you for the contribution.
You had your hand.
The golden rule seems like ineffective in the true horrors of this world. The true horrors of this world aren't on a personal level. They're on giant levels where governments step in and give permission to mistreat, subjugate, and humiliate a part of its population. And almost any nation you go to right now at this time, you will find that is in some form or some process. So it makes it appear as if the golden rule is ineffective in these giant cases, whether it's modern-day slavery, whether it's the, the Armenians who were slaughtered, or any of these horrendous situations, the Jews in Germany. So is it possible that we could use the golden rule really to correct these humongous evils?
Okay, so the question here is it possible to use the golden rule really to fix the great problems among the nations? Well, certainly to fix those problems, I mean, let's see, you know, one of the people who is credited with fixing those problems, it would be Mahatma Gandhi, or we would call him Mr. Gandhi because he asks us not to call him a Mahatma.
Right.
And his message was out to the people. What are you doing today? And to get the people all thinking in a common direction. So in this section, or in this case, it might be helpful to consider the golden ruler. And every person, every human being, every thinker has within himself a golden ruler. And what that golden ruler simply is, it's the exact, you know, different people have different motives, different people think differently, there's a different systems of thought and religions, etc. But all human beings have this one common golden unit of measurement within themselves, and it's the same. It's true morality. So the issue here is not what do I want to do or how should I help him. That issue is we all have to go within rather than be distracted from that which is without. And when we go within and see this unit of measure on our golden ruler, what we'll find is that even though it's identical among all of us, some of them see this is the unit of measure. Some of us see this is the unit of measure, and everything in between. Why? The reason is because of the instrument that we use to perceive that unit of measure. What's out of whack is the thoughts and the ideas that we use to perceive morality with. So really, when we see differences among ourselves, we have to stop first and recognize, is my instrument, my understanding of morality, is it perfect? And if it's not, who am I to judge the other? And the next step, of course, is to remind ourselves that it's our responsibility to do the work within ourselves to refine our instruments of perception so that we see that golden ruler as the true measure for what it is. And if every individual were to personally take responsibility for that, rather than relying on an imam or a rabbi or a priest to tell them what's going on with their own soul according to an outside doctrine, if everyone takes the personal responsibility to make the adjustments within himself, those are the steps in the right direction, it would seem.
Also, when we think about the golden rule, and it's just basically stated, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that whole idea of you or identity, normally we think of ourselves as persons or personalities, separate. Does theosophy give us any idea by which we can think of ourselves as something more or larger than just this personality by which we can base the golden rule?
Well, so is there a more accurate description or perception of the individual that will help us better implement the golden rule in our life? One of the great issues here among the nations is that we falsely identify ourselves with what? With the external circumstances and with our outer nature and our physical nature and our personal stuff that we want, when truly that's all here today and gone tomorrow, isn't it? Really, who are we and what are we? We are what? Eternal soul, all in union with each other, expressed through different bodies, but the truth is we are divine. We are a divine union, and if we see ourselves and as such and act from that basis and realize that everything I say, think, and every action I take in the presence or to affect another, really, aren't I just affecting soul? Is the he in thee is the he in me? So if we think and act from that basis, then chances are we're going to think slightly differently and act slightly differently than if we really think that these, you know, two different people are completely separate. And that's it. Yes.
In our modern society today, we see that there is nothing really new under the sun. It's simply the communication between families, society, and so forth is much greater. There is a disease, and the scientists call it masochism. There are many who wish to be punched, and when you realize that, you give that group or that individual enough room to do the beating themselves, on you perhaps, or on the group, and so forth. It has been discovered that by our compassion, our understanding, eventually that group or that individual will realize that they are out of sync and may come out and say thank you for putting up with me. Do unto others as you would have done to me.
Thank you for the contribution.
How does that work? What is that? What have I just said?
Of
how we conduct ourselves in society today, rather than having chips on our shoulders.
We have a contribution?
Well, just that we often find it's not easier, but makes more sense to apply the golden rule the other way. Not what I would want done to me, but don't do unto others what you wouldn't want done unto you. We think it makes it a bit easier to understand what you could or should do.
Thank you for the contribution.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Like ourselves and our natures, we are interconnected, and so these subjects that we will present are all interconnected. We're just going to look at them from different perspectives, and throughout the day we'll have created a interlocking mosaic of morality in our lives each time we take a look at it. So we'll have our second presenter come up now. And the question that we're going to consider is, who decides what is right? Moral decisions are based on something, someone. So who is it, what is it that should be the standard? Who is it that decides?
Well, we all know that all religions honor either a law or a being or a principle, and it is that which governs the entire universe. Therefore, it follows from that that it must also govern human affairs. And on that basis, the moral code or the ethics is established. But then, what is the source of this truth or principle or law? In Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and certain levels or varieties of Hinduism, it is a God who conceives of this law, and in giving it to humanity, sets the standards of behaviors. So therefore we have commandments, absolutes, that you should not do this or not do that. However, in other teachings, like in Buddhism or in the Tao, it is the universal transcendent law itself which rules the universe and therefore guides the ethical or moral behavior of humans. But regardless of these differences, all religions share a deep respect for law, even if they disagree with how that is controlled or used by humans. And humans are warned, all of us are warned, that we disobey these universal laws at our own peril. In some religions, it's you're condemned. In other religions, you are ostracized. And that is because it is accepted that the universe is a moral expression. And everyone does see that, at least outwardly, materially, it is a universe of law, of cause and effect. And therefore, human morality is not relative. We think it is, but it's not. There are certain laws at the basis of it, and it is at our own peril that we go against them. Some have said that ethics are rooted in reality just as much as the law of physics reflects itself. There's a wonderful expression in Confucianism. The moral law is found everywhere, and yet it is a secret. That is to say, there is no place in the highest heavens above, nor in the deepest waters below, where the moral law is not to be found. So obviously, humanity's problem is we're not looking for it, are we? We're looking for something else. So the way to salvation, it is taught by all of these religions, is to follow that law, that moral code, whether it's looking for a higher relationship with your own higher self, with the absolute in the universe, or what the Christian calls justification by their faith. The Hindu experiences as union with Brahman, and the Buddhist seeks as enlightenment. But today, there are moral and ethical questions that are absolutely new, that were unheard of. Just one example is shaming on the social media, which leads to a suicide. And we found what we think is the most incredible example of who decides what is right. 17-year-old Israeli girl back in 2011 was hit by a car and killed. And her parents donated all her organs and then sought, through the courts, permission to harvest her eggs. And the court gave the permission. But what the court would not do was allow them to be fertilized. They wanted to establish that the young lady actually had wanted to have children, and if she had wanted to have children, would she be willing to have a child after she was dead that would be raised by someone else? The ethicist in America, we don't know if any of you recall this, really reacted to this puzzle, this situation, and we could never discover any decision that ever came beyond that. the parents have the eggs frozen, but nothing has happened since then. The American ethicists were most concerned with the idea of a child being born from an egg from a dead human being, which is very odd because they allow it with sperm. People have had a son dying, and they have taken the sperm, and it's just, I don't know. The major issue, though, of course, is would she have wanted someone else to raise her child? And American ethicists pointed out most of us would not want our parents to raise our children, which is an amusing sort of moral statement anyway. Here in Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania, Arthur Kaplan, a bioethicist, a well-known bioethicist, wrote, "It seems very important to set up policies that will help guide us in making sound choices. That includes laws and individual hospital policies." But what it comes down to is, for example, what would a student of theosophy do to resolve such an issue? And herein lies the true answer to our question: who decides what is right? It is always the individual who must decide, who must seek out the best information they can find, turn to the highest wisdom that they know, and make the decision for themselves. So the ethics and morals that are standards out in the world, whether in religion or science or your local hospital, are guidelines, but the individual has to be the decision maker. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised you let me finish.
It's a moral decision. Right?
Yes.
Well, would a theosophist even be involved personally in these issues? We think that if there was more knowledge and common acceptance of the doctrines of reincarnation and karma, these wouldn't really even be issues.
You're making it sound like a theosophist is someone who's off by themselves. We have families, and a tragedy may happen within a family. But as long as someone does not understand that you are just here, it doesn't understand that the larger picture, the soul in incarnation, then you can understand parents lose their only beautiful, wonderful child, and there went the future of grandchildren and everything. So you understand their needs and their wants, but people don't understand this physical life is a temporary thing anyway. And as a young person, that girl would already be quickly reincarnating. So it's this twist that we have on the reality of life.
It's interesting, though, that the Israeli court really based their decision, which became the law, on what they perceived the individual would have chosen to do. In other words, they brought it down that it was her right to decide.
Yes,
what would she have wanted. And they respect it.
And that's why they can never answer the question.
Murky.
Yeah, yes. So it's been 4 years.
Yes.
One question. Now, it's easy to return being nice to someone when they're nice to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easy part. But what if somebody's not nice to you for a long, long time? You know? And years, 20 years, 30 years. And you just keep trying to be nice to them, and it's just not happening. So what can you do to keep yourself going?
Well, first, polish your sense of humor. And secondly, realize that as a student of theosophy, we attract the very problem that you're talking about. It's an exercise in growth and in patience and in a sense of humor. We think many theosophical students feel like the black sheep in their family. You know, nobody really understands them, and often they worry about them. Because if you really are trying to work on compassion, you're going against the tide of almost everything. So sometimes what we see as meanness towards us is fear. Fear that we're going to hurt ourselves by being too nice or spending too much time studying and not being out in the world, the real world. So all you can do is understand that it doesn't matter how anyone treats you, it's how you treat them.
Yes.
Yeah, I read a lot about, I'm not a nuclear physicist, but I read a lot of things about Robert Oppenheimer and this whole, the whole nuclear experience for everybody, every day. It's like, that opened up the door for like a lot of,
and he said
things.
That.
And I just look back at theosophical letters that I'm looking at, and it's like, people want to know what's going to happen every day. Even if they don't want to use Oppenheimer's name, me, I have to go look to see what he said, because he had ideas, to me, was similar to like, he was studying theosophy, but not saying it publicly.
Well, he did say when the bomb had actually been detonated, yeah, that we have opened up the Shiva, and destruction is a part of life. And it goes back to the earlier question. We have to destroy our attitude about the way someone is treating us. I mean, Theosophy teaches that we are an expression of, you deserve this. You desired this. Somehow you created the cause. So if you resist the negatives that people are bringing you, you maybe double them or quadruple them for your next life. Better to just take the attitude that says, I don't like this, and I don't have to like this, but it's not the fault of the person that's doing it. It's coming to me because it's mine. And maybe if I get a little nicer towards them, then they'll be free of having to do this.
In the back.
It's interesting, there are a lot of new television programs that have this very theme. They cultivate scientists and physicists, the most intelligent folks they can find, and tell them, here's the project. What they don't know is it's government funded. The government will eventually take the invention and use it in war. And when that is finally found out, the struggle for the creator, the ethical struggle, is tremendous. And they can't do anything because it's already been built. All they could do would be to destroy it, knowing that someone in the future would build it. So it's even in the race mind at this time that this is a common theme we see.
Well, if one of the things we're told by Mr. Judge is that the karma of Atlantis, which we all carry that karma, is being held back from us. So part of what we're seeing perhaps is memory from that. Perhaps that's exactly what we did, and these fiction writers are impressed to start pulling that out so that we look at the idea that we should not follow and do what we think is being done. We should investigate at the outset. Yes?
We forgot the most important part. They're offered tremendous amounts of money for this. So from the beginning, it's corrupted, but their desires are
right.
So awakened that they become blind.
But money is not corruption. It's the love of money that is the corruption. And we don't think most scientists and most researchers are after money, per se. We think they're after resolution and understanding something, solving a problem. I don't think they get seduced by the money. I think most of the rest of the world, all of us, does.
And once again, if we come to this basic idea that it is the individual who decides what is right, it means that as human beings, we are essentially moral beings, that we have the ability for free will and choice, which is lacking in the intelligence of the other kingdoms. So what does theosophy tell us about our nature as thinkers, why we have this ability to be moral beings and be free make free will and choice active in our life.
Actually, theosophy teaches that a human being stands in the only place where matter and spirit can meet, and that's in the mind and heart of a thinker. Everything else in nature acts within the framework of their development. We choose. And our problem is nobody has told us in our modern world, except theosophy, that with that choice, we fashion our own future lives. So as moral beings, we create the ethics and morals of our own little universe, and we return into it.
We find it interesting, the talk first was opened with, you know, the value of recognizing that everything operates under law, and it reminds us of, it reminds us that ideally the United States of America is a country, mm-hmm. I think the first, founded ideally on the rule of law, and so here it's not stopped in the name of the king, it's stopped in the name of the law. And interestingly enough, in this form of government, it actually requires the citizens to personally take more responsibility to be a citizen than really in any other form of government, because it's not as free.
Isn't it a pity that if they were to tell us we couldn't vote, 100% of the people would turn out demanding the right to vote. But because it's our responsibility, 35% will show up, and then the rest of them will just complain. If we took our responsibility seriously, wasn't it Ben Franklin who said, here's your republic if you can keep it? And it requires intelligent thought and a lot of frustration at times, but it's our responsibility to make those decisions. And then we have nothing to complain about if we have not put forth that effort. You know, we keep a copy of a photograph to remind us of privilege. It was taken from the air in South Africa, and it shows this S curve of human beings waiting to vote for the very first time. Some of them were in line over 8 hours. It gives us chills just to even think about that photograph. And here we ignore the privilege that we have. If somebody would just threaten to take it away, we'd all want it again. And that's kind of a pitiful statement about our moral decisions. We refuse to see that we are both the thinker in incarnation and the human personality of that incarnation.
Perhaps that desire, not, you know, that lackadaisical understanding of voting, is because the people don't see what they really want to express reflected in the governments that are leading them. But besides that, one of the ethical questions that we have that really is, I think, great, is the idea that we have blurred the idea of personhood, where now we wish to make corporations mm-hmm. into people, and when they do things, they don't suffer the consequences of people. So how can we make this work? How can we bring moral understanding?
We have to educate each other to why this is wrong. I mean, you will see that on the internet, people looking for support for altering these decisions that have been made. But we have to make people aware. But remember, sometimes it is the karma of a nation, a country, a group of people to suffer very badly until they begin to wake up. So in the end, as bad as things are and as they get worse, the worst thing would be to give up hope. We're working for a better future, not at this moment. So we're studying and making the effort to be prepared to help humanity when we can. Maybe we can't right now. Maybe humanity is deaf right now.
Thank you. How often have we admitted to ourselves in our silent, reflective moments that we meant well, but our good intentions created more problems, and maybe we shouldn't have done anything. And it complicates our moral decisions when we realize that our well-meaning isn't always enough. And so that is our question for our next presenter to consider: are good intentions enough?
We'd like to start with the definition of intention, because it's much broader than I ever imagined. There's a lot to it. It is stretching, intensity, will, and thought. And that comes to us from the French, but the French got it from Latin. Mm-hmm. And in Latin, originally it meant straining, effort, and attention, and also as stretching out and exertion. So, unfortunately, many of us, well, we won't say many of us, some, we'll say some, have intentions, but we don't really stretch out too much. We, kind of keep them to ourselves. And that's really the worst thing that we could possibly do, because it weakens our will. And being sentient beings, and as was mentioned earlier, it's only in man that matter and spirit meet, and that we have full self-consciousness and full free will. So we have gotten ourselves into a lot of trouble through the use of goodwill. Now, H.P. Blavatsky, she says that motive and motive alone makes the exercise of power become black, malignant, or white, beneficent magic. And we are all magicians, whether we realize it or not. We may not be initiated into some school of magicians, and at the United Lodge of Theosophists, we're not a school for that, because we're more concerned about the moral and ethical principles and getting them under control. But it is impossible to employ spiritual forces if there is the slightest tinge of selfishness remaining in the operator. So we all act. We can never not act. But we have to watch our intentions. We have to watch what we wish for, because, we just might get it. And so when it comes to money or power or position, if we're not ready for it, we can do a lot more harm than good. We can do terrible things in the world. So there's with intention, we have to look at kama, which is Sanskrit. It just means desire. The desire principle is kama. And in our classes on Wednesday evening, we're studying in the ocean of theosophy, and we've just completed kama loka, and it's that the kama is a passion, which is the place of desire, passions and desires. That's where our lower passions and desires are sloughed off, and they dissipate into the astral. So kama can be used for the benefit of all, or it can be mean, selfish, and separative. All embodied existence came about through kama or desire. Desire arose within it, is the saying. And it is the primal germ of mind. So will stands behind desire. So
there's this desire for embodied existence, which also becomes a necessity through with karma means literally action, and reincarnation is how the karma is how we try to balance it out. Ideally, we balance it out to a point where we're not making any negative karma for ourselves. We've dealt with all of our issues, and that is like in the case of an adept or a master, they are strictly here for the good. They sometimes are embodied and sometimes disembodied, working behind the scenes. There's the guru parampara chain, which is that line of adepts and masters and their disciples, and of course we're part of that too. Many of us, if not all of us, have been through some sort of initiations in the past, but we're here for our faults. We're not here, you know, right now we're here for our faults, not for our good. So we need to put right thought, right intention together with right action. It's far better to act and err than to sit and stare frozen in fear. The saying attributed to Jesus the Christ is, faith without works is dead.
So the gist of this presentation is, whereas intention or desire carried out, even in a good direction, will bring results, it certainly does take all our faculties as human beings, imagination, thought, understanding, compassion, to bring forth the best fruit of that action. So as was pointed out in the quote, we need to add faith or knowledge of our real nature, conviction of our real nature as spiritual beings to our intentions in order to be those magicians that you refer to. Yes?
A question. I don't want this to be a stumper.
We don't know. We don't know. It's simple.
Two parts to the question. One, can a master or an adept have a slip? And two, if they do, should we just throw the baby out with the bathwater and or cover it up? Or what you?
Well, in a sense, we could go back to Tsongkhapa in 1375, who resurrected the Theosophical movement after 1,000 years of virtually no activity in the world. We call them the Dark Ages. The adepts all got together and had a meeting. They can meet without meeting. They can, in their minds, they can, you know, we don't, maybe they met together, maybe they just, some of them couldn't make it, but in their minds, there were dissenting voices. There were dissenting voices that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be bringing this knowledge forth now. Maybe, you know, they're not ready. So whether that was a mistake or not, we can't judge. We hope not, because we're very grateful. And it didn't become truly public until 1875 with the founding of the Theosophical Society. So there was 500 years of efforts behind the scenes with the Rosicrucians, the Masons, the Alchemists, you know, but they were small underground groups, and they did that, you know, at their peril. They often were persecuted. That's a whole other subject, but there was certainly a lot of persecution. So do they make mistakes? Well, it's hard to say. We don't know, really.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, just, we don't think we could call them mistakes, because even the ones who would have disagreed about the effort at that time, they would be disagreeing on the basis of compassion. Maybe it's too soon, and some people will try and fail, and it'll be worse for them. So we don't think it's mistakes. It's the level of perception of a master is not even something that we can imagine. So they see the future and the past, and it's a tremendous responsibility.
We can say unequivocally that we're not there yet.
Yes.
Our understanding is that they have said that they do not claim infallibility, and that actually makes sense, because what is a master? What is a Mahatma? He's a perfected human being, which really means, theosophically, as perfect a human being as anyone can be in this period of evolution. They don't claim absolute perfection, so then who can claim absolutely being right always?
Well, there is one person, but on matters of morals. Yes. It's relative. That's the thing that certain terms are confusing, like absolute. It means during this, the perfection means that which is attainable in this great cycle of evolution, which goes to 16 figures.
We think that the unequivocal answer would be, as suggested, being human on this plane, they are certainly susceptible to error, as we all are. So much so that one of the first items of the secret doctrine is the fact that no one idea or vision or teaching of any adept, no matter how great, perceived or honored in the world, was accepted as being true until it was tested, checked, and verified by numerous other adepts over ages, and until it stood as independent evidence of truth, proved by repeated experiment, by repeated verification. And that same process is implied on us. So theosophy is put forth, we say, is not just a religious idea or a philosophical expression. It is a science based on laws of nature, which took millennia to figure out and confirm, and is continuously being confirmed because we know we are checked, because we live in a universe whose very nature is change and transformation. So the search for truth is continuous, because we are all, as human beings, subject to some kind of limitation. Yes?
One word we didn't hear for this topic was discrimination. Mm-hmm. And our question would be, is that necessary to know when to intervene with good intentions? Mm-hmm. And if so, how do we cultivate it?
Yes. There's another word we use often here, discrimination. It's not meant discriminating against a person or a group or religion or color or creed, because certainly all are welcome and encouraged to come. It is using the discriminating principle of mind, of testing, checking, and verifying. And it's a process. It's better to act with good intentions with all the knowledge that you have than to do nothing, we think. It's always better to act, because that's the only way we learn anyway. And if we're not acting maliciously, then, you know, we're not incurring any great ill, we don't think.
For those of you who may be familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is teaching his disciple Arjuna, who is a warrior engaged in the middle of a battle, on the philosophical and ethical principles of life, just as we're trying to do today, discuss dialogue on these principles while we're engaged in the moral battles and decisions of life. And after 18 chapters of going back and forth and questioning, he finally says to Arjuna, "I have placed before you all this knowledge. Now act as best as seemeth unto thee." And of course he does, and after the battle he sort of forgot what he was told and had to have it repeated to him. But that's part of the point, that we continuously try to gain knowledge because we understand at any one point we can only act with the best intentions that we have, but it's not enough. Therefore, we constantly feel within our higher nature, that divine nature, that growing part of our nature, that urge to know more, to gain wisdom. Yes?
Well, that small voice that sometimes talks to us in these kinds of situations, you know, we've read many things and we remember it, but sometimes we don't remember it in this brain, but it's remembered somewhere else, and it seems to come into us when we are in a situation where we have to make a decision or we have to know what's best to do. Sometimes we hear a little voice that says, "Yes, go do that. Go do that. Yes." And sometimes we don't listen to that. So.
Could you speak up? I couldn't hear that voice.
Well sometimes. Well, that's what happens.
So that voice of conscience or the voice of inspiration, voice of conscience that tells us what not to do, or the voice of inspiration which we feel but don't always listen to, where's that coming from? Is it coming from the brain?
Is that voice coming from the brain? Well, the brain is an instrument of mind. The brain in itself is a wonderfully complex organ, but there's mind, there's universal mind, where we're all connected, and it is a principle, and it can be developed through moral action. So it's known as manas in theosophy, and it's dual. There's a higher and a lower, and that's the battle in the Bhagavad Gita. That's the battle that rages within all of us is how to act, and. And as was said, you act what seemeth best unto thee, but you act. If you don't act, then you are just accumulating. I mean, it's in a sense a sin of omission is worse than a sin of commission, because if we don't act, we're just a personal aside. We were waiting for the subway a couple years ago. And there was a young man who was standing on the edge of the platform, and he was rocking back and forth. He was disturbed, obviously. And I just said, "I've got to do something, because he might jump in front of this train." And he acted like that's what he wanted to do. And I just tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, "You're not going to jump." And he said, "Oh, no." And he went away. I don't know. We don't know if we interrupted that thought or not. We hope that we did. But that's just a small example of something that's, you know, it doesn't take much effort, really. Often it doesn't take much effort. A kind word, a smile, encouragement, you know, as long as it's sincere, if it's not, you know, not false. You don't want to say things to people that aren't true, but we can always find something to, you know, there's many opportunities out there, and that's just a small example. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Now the moderator is going to need some moderation, so we'll have some come up and assist us.
We don't really think this is going to work, right? I own the sign.
Okay.
You own the microphone.
Okay. So our fourth question for our initial segment this afternoon. As a question, suffering. When is it good? When is it bad or just ugly? And in thinking about that, it occurred to us that the Buddha taught that the first noble truth is that life is full of suffering and pain. Of course, it's not entirely full of suffering. We do have some pleasant experiences. However, they're temporary, and transient nature makes them wounds of pain, especially when we desire and lust after and want to hold on to and cling to those transient experiences. So good, bad, and ugly, when we just think of them as adjectives, as experiences, a good, bad, or ugly experience, they're relative and depend on the attitude and knowledge of the one who is witness of the experience. So at one point of our lives, that which we think is good, bad, or ugly could be completely different from another point in our lives, and it depends, in, you say, how we've grown in our understanding and also attitude and what we value in life. So deciding whether an experience now is good or bad is a moral judgment, and as was already said, it's based on reasoning from established principles, whether those principles are taught in our society by our ethicists, in religion or philosophy, or maybe just from our parents. So judging an experience to be ugly, though, is not so much based on our moral reasoning, but is based on the value we place on our sensory experience. So that if experience is inconvenient or unpleasant to hear or see or uncomfortable, in a way we say it's ugly. So we came in to the meeting this morning and maybe we're standing too close to the street and the bus comes by and splashes us all with water. Well, that's an ugly experience. We wouldn't say it's a morally bad suffering or a good suffering, but it's certainly unpleasant. Of course, if it generates us throwing a stone at the bus, it could be a bad experience of suffering. And if we instead practice some patience and compassion and maybe learn something about not standing too close to the end of the pavement, it was a good suffering experience. So a life then, being that this noble truth is full of suffering, it is constantly full of painful experiences and suffering that we judge to either be good, bad, or ugly. So suffering then is an experience that is good. As experience is good when we see it as being instructive, meaningful, purifying, strengthening, right, proper, and fit. In other words, we decide whether, on those criteria, whether our suffering is good for us or sometimes for somebody else too. Suffering as an experience is bad when we judge it or see it as being injurious, incorrect, faulty, invalid. We don't want to see somebody suffer what we can see is inappropriate or too harshly or unjustly or unfairly or hurt in any way unnecessarily. That we would see as being a bad experience of suffering. Suffering is, as we said, is experienced as being ugly when it is just seen to be unpleasant, offensive, disgusting to the senses, inconvenient or uncomfortable. So sometimes having to get out of bed in the morning is an ugly suffering experience. It's not particularly good or bad. So what difference does it make, really, whether something is good, bad, or indifferent, or ugly? And the difference has to do with, because we make moral decisions based on that, but how we perceive our suffering. So we thought we might bring in the Bhagavad Gita here. Those who are familiar with it know that it teaches that there are three general qualities in nature, that of sattva, which is the good and truth, the beautiful, that of rajas, which is that of desire, passion, and that of tamas, which is indifference. So we might say that suffering as a cause is good when it results in morally excellent, virtuous, righteous, honorable, and friendly kind of actions, and when it results in the desire and search for truth. And so we say suffering in this case has the quality of suffer, because it leads us to search for something better, good, for ourselves and others. Suffering is a cause for bad when it results in the opposite kind of action, or when it results in the search and desire for more pleasure. In this case, it partakes of the quality of rajas. So the person who experiences so much in suffering that they only become more callous in mean in for themselves, that sort of generates a kind of suffering that is bad under the influence of the rajas. Suffering is a cause that is just ugly when it results in indifference, inaction, and a continuation of our ignorance. In this case, it partakes of the quality of tamas. It leads to nothing. It leads to stagnation. It leads to giving up. It leaves from just withdrawing, doing nothing, not making any progress. And so it would be a moral decision whether it's worse to be caught in that kind of condition or do something bad. But it's obviously of a darker nature. So in the Bhagavad Gita, it does speak of us transcending the qualities. So suffering can lead to a transcendence of these good, bad, and ugly aspects of our life if it leads us to learn that there is only one enduring reality, and that is ourselves, and that we are all interdependent and interconnected. If it teaches us this is a universal law, we basically get what we set up for, and if we work in the right way, we're going to make a better destiny for ourselves in the future. When suffering leads us to take more self-responsibility, to work through our problems, it teaches us something that helps us transcend it. When suffering teaches us the only way we can progress is through compassion and service to other, it is a transcending influence. So when we understand this, we can see why all the great teachers, including HPB, have said, woe to him who has not suffered. So we open it now then for your questions and comments.
I guess when people, they can be going through a famine, people have famines, and it can bring a lot of suffering, it has brought a lot of suffering, but the opposite side I look at is that people will generally come to their aid. You don't know why they do it, but they get up and they just go there and help. I mean, it's a way I can look at the world like that a lot of times, that it's a lot of suffering inside, but sometimes that suffering might bear you of the things I need to have learned about, because sometimes we don't see our own selves as suffering when we see people starving to death, or people just don't have food, I know that. Yes. But then, you know, I see that people morally might come in that aspect of, not just a Buddhist, but he comes because he knows that he got a compassion for, it's poverty in my life, but it's not the same ruinous poverty. Mm-hmm. It's just a compassion that I must help those who suffer, because I know what suffering really good looks physically.
See, there's two different extremes regarding suffering, and Buddha, teaching it as a noble truth, tried to teach us to be in the middle, the great median, the in between. So it's wrong to look at suffering as an absolute evil, which we need to avoid. And we know so much in our culture is biased towards the idea that suffering has no value, so much so that if there's too much suffering, well, that's justifiable in itself to terminate one's life, or to put a family into poverty because they have to pay for the continued care of their parent or family, or don't try to help your people at all because there's too much involved. Suffering involved is you avoid it. You want to just live a life of pleasure. On the other hand, our attitudes towards suffering could be that we just give into it. We're passive. It's just accepted. It's a part of life. It's our karma. It's our fate. You know, we just have to deal with it by not dealing with it. So somewhere in between, we have to recognize that, first of all, what we suffering, whether it's good, bad, or ugly, is a relative judgment. But also, it leads to action. the kind of decision we make, whether it's good, bad, or ugly, is going to impel us to act. Now, we may act and be indifferent, which is a choice. We can act to do the wrong thing, or we can act to do something better. But it's recognizing suffering is a noble truth. Buddha didn't say it's a necessary evil. He didn't say it's an unfortunate part of life. He says it's a noble truth. There's nobility in it if we have some knowledge about ourselves and that we are here to learn.
And there'd never be any compassion without the recognition of someone's suffering. There's that wonderful little Tibetan story. The young prince falls from his horse and breaks his leg, and everyone is just adamantly, this is the worst thing that could possibly happen. And the king's response was, maybe so, maybe not. And then a few months later, all of the young men are conscripted and taken away to be in the army, except for this wounded prince who stays to grow old and rule the kingdom beautifully. Maybe so, maybe not. So who knows what suffering is suffering?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We were thinking of the story earlier, the actual event, where the couple lost their child and were so overcome. We wonder if, rather than that death, the child developed a debilitating disease that would last most of their life, which would the parents choose? The karma...
What do you mean, which would the parents choose?
To lose her when she's young.
Oh, we see.
Quickly, or to watch her die.
Thank goodness none of us ever have that choice.
Well,
wouldn't that be awful?
It's a karmic blessing in disguise that, as was said at the time, you can't fathom that.
Right.
But this happens, so this won't. Something worse won't.
We have a slogan we made up for ourselves to remind ourselves. Bad things happen, so worse things won't. Mr. Keogh.
Yes, yes.
Just a comment that on someone who was a child, they do have a decision. That's what this horrible thing called abortion is in existence today. And many people do decide to kill that child in the womb, knowing that it may be born with some disease that will kill it 20 or 10 or 3 years later.
Yes.
So we do have that decision.
Yeah, we have to make those decisions all the time. Now, sometimes they're in our families, sometimes they're in our everyday lives. But don't let the quality of suffering transcend it. And how do we do that? Well, if we don't become proactive in life, we put ourselves in the position where we will be the victims of the reaction that comes on to us. And this goes on. If you don't take the proactive stance of putting on a smile, of being nice to somebody, maybe because you're walking around with a smirk or like you don't care, that's going to generate more suffering for yourself. So you need to be proactive. So if we don't take the effort to learn the lessons of life about our oneness with nature, our interdependence, the responsibility that we have, that we do have hope and dignity if we are understanding the laws and acting accordingly, if we don't actively try to gain that knowledge, then suffering is going to teach us. It's going to be our best teacher. And no one should want to put themselves in the position to deprive another person of those lessons. But we can all try to give somebody the opportunity to benefit. And that doesn't mean if somebody's starving, you teach them about reincarnation and karma. You feed them first and give them water and satisfy that need. But now you can say, hey, there's dignity. There's opportunity in your condition. You can make the world better. You can make yourself better from your condition. You understand something about yourself and life that you could not understand if everything were spoon-fed from you and given to you automatically from the moment you came out of your mother's womb. You have a great blessing here with this. So there's so many ways in which we can make moral decisions to help if we understand the nobility of suffering.
And we just want to say, if you ever deal with someone who has that very question or problem of destroying a life because of a future illness or problem, ask them to get a copy of a book written by Dale Evans, who was married to Roy Rogers. And the book is called Angel Unawares. And it's a child that they had that affected everyone around them. Child could not hear, could not see, and yet just radiated all of this love and beauty. So we think we can offer help to people who face decisions like that. And then, of course, if it were possible to mention reincarnation and karma, that soul needs that experience. And if it doesn't get it through this particular family, it will get it from a lesser one, because karma does not stop. It looks for opportunities.
I'm sorry, yes.
This may sound a bit simplistic, but I think we need to keep in mind that suffering happens. Mm-hmm. And it just happens to all of us, and in one way it builds character, in another way it gives those around us the opportunity to assist the person who is suffering. On the other hand, what is probably everyone will agree what is wrong is to purposely inflict suffering on someone. That is about the worst thing that can happen.
It's interesting. Is it worse to inflict suffering or to allow suffering to go on when you can help it but you don't? Once again, it becomes a moral decision, how much knowledge we have. And what we would talk about suffering, the coach who is training the Olympian for the gold medal is going to put that person through a rigorous training program, and they will actually have to learn to work through the pain. Arnold Schwarzenegger talked about how he would have to work and work at what he did to become the top in his field in bodybuilding, to the point where he fainted. And once he fainted, he knew he did his best. You know, so indifferent to struggle and pain, what other people would say is forcing somebody to suffer, from the person receiving it, it's not necessarily, but as an opportunity for growth.
And our time is up. We are going to have a break until 2:20.
2:40.
Oh, it is 2:20.
Yes.
Break is over, sorry. We'll see you back here at 2:40. You have 20 minutes. Or is that 10 minutes? No, it's
20 minutes.
Can't tell time either.